Welcome to Culture, Talent, and Growth. Join Anish Shah and the Ruckus team as they invite dynamic leaders to share what they've learned about creating lasting culture, attracting great talent, and achieving sustainable growth. Let's get started.
Hi, everyone, and thank you for joining us today. This is former HubSpot leaders scaling a B2B marketing organization. Anish will be hosting us. Anish, the mic's up to you.
Cool. I'll give a quick rundown of my background. Previously, I used to run growth for companies, both full-time and as a consultant, for around a decade, and then transitioned into building out an executive recruiting firm, specifically focused on hiring executive marketing growth GTM leaders for a wide variety of scaling startups. And I'm excited to host this event today. Let me kick it off over to Sam, if he wants to give a little bit of his bio there as well.
My name's Sam Mallikarjun. I was the head of growth at HubSpot Labs back in the day. Then went to a company called BirdEye with MK for a while. And after that was chief revenue officer at Flock.com. And then this year left and started OneScreen.ai. So creating a new platform for smart screens in the real world.
Can you dive a little bit more into what OneScreen does outside of the four-word elevator pitch?
Yeah, I mean, we're spending, you know, hundreds of billions of dollars a year at marketing, app development, advertising on just two types of screens. So desktop laptops and mobile devices, whereas screens in the real world are generally like still dumb and unconnected. So if you're at an airport, if you're at your doctor's office, et cetera. And so our little device plugs into any screen and just turns it into a smart screen. So it can detect, you know, people nearby. So you can sell ads or it could be used by those people who are nearby. And then it connects it to the real-time content network and real-time ad auction, which is how all media monetizes to begin with.
Awesome. And wait, how long have you been working on that?
We started in March. It was originally just a hackathon to help small businesses. Got together with a few other HubSpotters, and we had the idea of like, what if Facebook audience network existed for the real world? So, you know, a bar or a restaurant or whatever could make more money. Then we ran in what we half jokingly called reverse stealth mode, called everybody in the out-of-home ad space, found out that nobody had the technical skill or economic concepts to execute on this, like take and run with it. So Yeah, now we're 9 people and hitting the ground running. So we're expanding into New York and California next month. And as Jen was saying before we started, right, it's the bad life decision to do early stage tech startups.
Nice, which is a great transition into, would love to learn more about you, Jen.
Sure. Hi, I'm Jen, and I'm in an early stage tech startup. Bad life decision. I'm currently chief revenue officer at Orson, which is a brand new fintech startup to facilitate whole loan trading between financial institutions. But this is my first fintech. I love to learn and I love startups, which means I have worked at lots of different companies. I was pretty early at HubSpot and joined in 2009 and left in 2011, took a brief stint through Amazon. And then I've been basically playing with startups ever since, from recruitment to big data for e-commerce to multi-touch marketing attribution that was acquired by Marketo. Here you can see that I was chief marketing officer at Madison Logic until I got bitten by the startup bug again. So I'm excited to be here.
Yeah, we're super excited to learn from you. And then MK, I would love to learn more about you and your background.
Yeah, hey, I'm MK. I too work in small startup tech startups. Started at HubSpot way back in 2013, and my tenure there was wild, upside down, inside out. I had so many different identities, so many different roles. I ended up working in a marketing consultant role, which is actually where Sam and I met for the very first time, working to consult our e-commerce customers, and then left HubSpot 4 years later, somehow found my way all around the world to open some of their international offices, and then also People Ops. Like, I found my way to the People Ops organization. Very strange. Like, if you don't say no to the career opportunities that unfold for you, you'll end up in some really wild places, which is also how I ended up in Dallas, Texas, where Sam had recruited me down to BirdEye, where I was their director of demand generation. And I found my way back to Boston, where I'm now the head of marketing at Alice, which is an AI augmented personal gifting platform for B2B businesses. A little jargony, but we just use AI to help you figure out what people you want to do business with actually want to receive instead of the traditional frame rate direct mail.
Cool. Alice is a super interesting product. So basically, someone gives you all of their prospects and like some kind of contact information for them? And it does it message them and ask what gift they would prefer? Or like, how does that work?
No, actually, even better. We don't take our customers' data at all. We actually just give them access to the platform themselves. And it sits alongside all their other MarTech solutions, their marketing automation platforms, even their sales automation platforms. And they will then enter in the contact information, and our AI will use public domain data points that are out there on the abyss of social media to identify their personal interests and then select gifts that map most closely to those personal interests. So for example, I could find out that Jen loves food tours, and she spends time actually taking a lot of pictures of the food that she goes on food tours for. So I might actually send her a subscription to the food tours of Seattle. And she could, in the marketplace, say like, yes, this is exactly what I've been hoping for. Or she could be like, hey, I actually do this on every single weekend that I live here, so I don't need this. Instead, I'm going to go to the marketplace and swap for something that's actually valuable to me, which could be anything from a BarkBox subscription to a Yeti mug, or flip it over to donations for a nonprofit organization that could be near and dear to her heart.
Okay, very cool. And like, what have you learned has been the gifts that most often people are wanting?
Because I'm a marketer, we wrote an ebook about this. Because folks want to know, they always want the shortcuts, right? Marketer, when you're marketing to marketers about marketing, which is a phrase that Sam is notorious for saying.
Yes.
They want to know the shortcuts, right? They just want to know, like, give me the TLDR so that I can just plug and play because I got 15 other things going on at once. So surprisingly, Yeti mugs. People love their Yeti mugs. And as much as we say branded swag is like not as cool, like I don't have any branded swag from companies that I don't do business with, but like people just love Yeti mugs. It doesn't, like, I don't know what it is. They just really love them. There you see? Case in point, Green Bay Packers, brand affiliation of the pack. It's wild.
I mean, those mugs aren't cheap, right? It's not like some random like discount gift store mug that you're dragging that's like white and just has some paint on it, right? Those are made with quality for all of your camping excursions, right?
Exactly. Yeah. I personally don't get it. I don't know why, but it is the Mercedes-Benz of cups. So I get it. It's like a big jump outside of the like red Solo cup life. I get it.
That's awesome. Yeah. I think whenever I go to conferences, like the best swag I ever got was socks. Like if you're flying somewhere and you just have like an extra pair of socks and just it's sitting there in your luggage, you're like, this is cool. I have more socks than I planned for. Like, you're definitely going to tap out of like spiral organizers and like pens and stress balls, right? Like stuff that you never really wanted in the first place. But yeah. I don't know. Who doesn't have enough socks?
I hate socks. They're never sized for my feet. They're the worst swag. So we're just going to have to agree to disagree there.
This is why I'm like, our bar is set so low. People love socks and they love this is job security for me. Or like, people hate socks. Great. Go after those Yeti cups. It does not matter. Like, pick what you want. That's great. That's the whole point of our platform.
That's awesome. And also, I've met the first person on earth that I thought I'd ever meet who hates socks. So this is like...
I like socks. I hate socks as swag.
Oh, okay. I thought it was just
because they're all sized bigger than mine. And so you pick them up at a booth. They're not useful. You get them in the mail. Again, not useful. They're usually with a t-shirt that's also not my size. But I digress massively.
You get it, though. We always joke, like, don't send cupcakes to a keto enthusiast. Like, don't send one-size-fits-all socks to someone who has small feet or extra-large feet. And don't send t-shirts to people who are very particular about their, like, schmedium. They're, like, halfway between a small and a medium. They love their schmedium. Like, that's fine. That's the whole point. I won't get on my soapbox any further.
Whole webinar just on socks.
Sign me up.
I could do that. I mean, one of our clients is Bombas, the sock company, who kind of makes the most like cushiest socks on planet Earth.
I have a pair on right now.
Well, there we go. So I guess there are some socks that you do love.
Product placement happening here. We got Yeti, we got the Bombas socks.
So. Chocolatey Ovaltine here as well, too.
Perfect. So I guess we'll jump into questions that we got from the registrants, particularly about B2B marketing, which has nothing to do with socks or anything we were just talking about. But, you know, as you're building out your channels, what is one very often overlooked channel that actually has, you know, performed and whatever your KPIs are for performance that people don't realize?
I always say that every channel works until it doesn't. Like, we're seeing the genesis of this direct mail, right? But I remember when I started at HubSpot in 2009, everyone's like, direct mail is dead. Everyone hates it. It's the worst thing in the world. I went from there into email. And email was how many times has email been dead and then back alive again? And then dead again and then back alive again? Same with social. So it's always like, you got to look for the holes, at least in my experience. I don't know what you guys think.
Yeah, I mean, direct mail is definitely not dead. It's just been reimagined now with AI as part of it. I'm 1,000% with you, Jen, right? It's like everybody, if anybody's ever watched little kids play soccer, marketers are very much like little kids playing soccer. And then we all just gravitate to the side of the field that has the ball and the most recent shiny object. And so we'll all gravitate to that, which means that there's plenty of open space on the other side of the field for somebody to try a new piece of technology. So that technology could be direct mail, it could be email, it could be LinkedIn and social selling, or it could be video and how you think about your video and your content that you have out there. So really, it's just the over the channel is the one that people are not glomming over right now.
So essentially, you're saying go somewhere that people aren't kind of over-indexing on and then focus on making that work because it's not sort of overloaded with too many marketers kind of banging on it.
Exactly.
Okay.
Don't overlook co-marketing. At HubSpot, I had to build the e-commerce team. And, you know, we didn't have a lot of e-commerce folks. We were a B2B company. So connected with Magento. And the Magento folks are like, wait, we don't have to do the webinar. And we still get to tell our boss that we did work this quarter. You know, so you could either be the people with distribution or be the people with content. I mean, marketers marketing to marketers about marketing. You guys know what's going on here. Like, I went from having 8 million leads in my CRM to 8,000 leads in my CRM. So any company that says, hey, do you want to do a webinar with me? I'm like, yeah, that's distribution to somebody else's audience. So co-marketing, especially when you've got a good overlap in complementary products, you know, which chaps a lot, right? E-com plus email automation equals winning.
Yeah, I love that. I'll dive in and say, now that, I don't know if all of you have this, but, you know, I get hit up almost daily on LinkedIn by someone trying to sell me LinkedIn lead gen services. So almost as meta as Sam's favorite phrase, but, and they're all templated. Not one of them has looked at my company, knows me, knows anyone in common with me, anything like that. So I'd say like one very often overlooked area that it's basically, you know, sales 101, send an email that isn't templated. You know, if there's like a big prospect you're going after, just literally say, hey, I know your name is this. I saw your company does this. And the amount of response rates that we're able to get from just saying, hey, I took 8 seconds to look at your LinkedIn and your company's website has driven so many new conversations for us. Because in this day and age of templating, and so I don't know how LinkedIn even allows so many like lead gen people to hit your inbox, but yeah, it really goes a distance. And I guess it does speak to a little bit of what you were saying. Like, don't look at the channel, just look at something that's being overlooked by other people. And that's kind of like a way to stand out. And to what you were saying with the co-marketing, Sam, on the flip side, we're using this whole experience right here where we invite panelists and so forth as a way of starting conversations, right? I didn't know either of you, you know, over a week ago. And then now suddenly I have three amazing marketing executives that we now have a relationship with. So inviting people onto your events, doing, you know, we're now building out a more, a lengthier and more kind of intense system where we're getting a bunch of executives to, you know, do interviews on our blogs and stuff like that. So I'm not the first person to ever think of doing this, of flattering people by inviting them to be panelists. But it is something that tends to, you know, grow relationships beyond just, you know, quick emails.
The messaging template topic's interesting. My co-founder, Greg, has just horrendous spelling and grammar, and it gives me so much anxiety whenever I'm CC'd on like an email to a prospect. But then we were talking about, at least the person on the other end knows that's not an automated email. Because no self-respecting marketer would have that
I've
kind of
had sales leaders specifically drive me insane. I'm like, but that's a template. That's in our outreach. Like, well, yeah, but then they think it's real. I'm like, oh, you're probably right.
There's been multiple blog posts that said, you know, you should actively misspell words or use like slightly incorrect grammar, because then it just looks like you wrote an email in a rush to someone instead of it being like, hello, you know, bracket name. My company, bracket company, sells these tools. your company, bracket name, you know, might want them. So, yeah.
I'm guilty of doing that. We used to write the email copy for our BDRs. And in one of the steps in the sequence, so it's just that we swap the C and an E. And then the follow-up email in the sequence is, oh my gosh, apologies for my misspelling, I before you accepted your C. And that email got the most replies because people thought it really was a person saying like, oh my gosh, I totally botched that moment. So again, people will gravitate towards the soccer ball in the field. So don't everybody go out there and start misspelling things. No. The key that you were talking about, Sam, though, is the approach. The more authentic you are with the approach, not the channel, but the approach that you take within the channel, that's where effectiveness comes into play.
That's super interesting. And I think one argument I've had with a lot of people who have, and I don't have any traditional sales experience or BDR experience, or I've seen zero metrics at scale. But one of the arguments I have with people is that last line at the bottom of the emails that say, hey, do you have 20 minutes free for me to chat with you? And that whenever I see that at the bottom of the email, I always get like irritated. Like if you just remove that, maybe this email would be a little bit better. But like, because obviously you're trying to sell me something. Obviously, you know, if I was interested, I'd reply back. But I don't know. Have you guys seen some like interesting results from that? Because in my gut feels like removing that would make the email more digestible. But then I get that it forces an actual CTA.
Just like that last line CTA, everything works until it doesn't. So do you have 20 minutes? The answer is flat no. I don't know when that's going to work again. The one that I saw, I almost fell for. I'm really bad with salespeople. I almost fell for, and then now is a flat no, is do you have 15 minutes so that we can learn how we can help each other? Because now I'm like, oh, that's evil. I don't know. I don't know of what might work as a CTA other than, are you interested or not? Like, let's not waste each other's time. But that's me. And as I said, I'm kind of horrible to salespeople. I don't know what others think.
I almost never reply. I've replied to maybe one or two just because they did something. I don't know. There was something human that was in there. And I think they tricked me into thinking that they actually wrote the email instead of it being a template. So
it came from MK, actually.
Yeah, it's happier. Here.
That's awesome. But no, I think you bring up a really good point in terms of everything works until it doesn't, right? Once I've seen like every single SDR email say, hey, can I get 20 minutes of your time? I'm like almost angry, like, no, you cannot. I don't want to hear about this random software I had no interest in the first place for 20 minutes. And I think what might get me is if they say, hey, I don't need to jump on the phone with you. Here's a link to my pitch deck. And I can like just go see whatever details are for myself and see if their pitch deck is like good and nicely designed and all of that. So I'm still waiting for that, for someone just to email me their pitch deck without me having to get on the phone with them. Cool. If you could only have three people on your team to start, what functions / roles would they be and why? This is actually a great question for all three of you, because it seems like all three of you are kind of building out or have recently built out kind of early stage teams and different kind of sectors. I believe, Jen, that you're kind of new-ish at your organization and probably will have to kind of make this decision soon. So like, if you want to tell me a little bit more about how you would think through this.
Sure. I've got two approaches to this. One is, what does the company need? And then the other is, what do I need? No two organizations are exactly the same, as much as we'd like to say. And so marketers really want, here's how to do it. The answer is not, here's how to do it, because maybe you've joined an organization where you've got a really strong sales ops person who's been running your marketing automation system as well. Well, then why am I wasting money on a marketing ops person, for example? Sometimes SDRs roll up into demand gen, sometimes they don't, right? So it all depends on, so what do you need? But basically, I like to make sure that I've got product marketing covered, because if I'm in, most of my B2B companies have been tech companies, so messaging and launches, demand gen is still a thing. I actually look at it all the way up and down the funnel, and I look at it for ABM. I tend to do enterprise organizations or folks that sell to enterprise organizations. And then it's like brand, buzz, and what else you need in your industry. So those are my three roles. I figured I should actually answer the question. The other side of it is, what do I need? So for example, I've done demand gen, but I'm stronger in product marketing. So I'm going to hire a demand gen person before a product marketer, because I know that I can run a launch. I also look at it not only from a functional perspective, but what are my weaknesses? My first hire, I really try to hire to my own weaknesses. And that means learning my own weaknesses, which you don't always want to own up to. But for example, I know that I'm great at creating a process, except that I always skip steps. So having someone on my team who can look at the process before I roll it out so that people don't think I'm a complete idiot is always a good thing to have.
Love that. Okay. I love that you spelled it out and you actually went through your kind of methodical reasoning, which is what do I or the teams that or the people in the organization that we're currently just end up not being great at ourselves and hire up for that. Any other thoughts? I guess, Sam, you had to build up a pretty big team at HubSpot, but then now you're building up a very different kind of product that you're selling maybe in a different way. Would love to hear how you sort of thought of your initial team for that.
Yeah. To Jen's point, especially when you have a team that's small, for me, it's mostly about balance. So we just hired our first marketer and at OneScreen, and he's energetic and outgoing and creative and all the things I'm not. You know, I can write 50,000 words, but I can't write 50. And, you know, he sort of like fills that gap. So definitely identifying how do you create balance? Where do you fit in? If the CEO has a marketing background, that's usually a bad thing, but you don't need, you know, like the economics thing. I didn't need somebody who specialized in SaaS economics and marketing and stuff like that, because I generally already had that covered. And then the third role is somebody who's been the customer is always ideal, because, you know, content marketing or sales enablement, et cetera, it's about the teaching, the consultative sales process. And it's really, you can be creative and you can be logical and methodical, but you can't fake like empathy and experience. It's hard to find in some industries, except unless you're in MarTech, and because again, marketing to marketers. But if you can find a great marketer who can, you know, put themselves in the customer's shoes, that's always a good third way to fill out. And then combine that with the methodical and the creative, and that's your content marketing engine.
I love that point about finding someone who's been in the customer's shoes before, because so rarely are B2B companies actually looking for that, even though you're trying to get behind the mind of who your end customer is going to be. When we run B2B searches for different organizations, very rarely do they say, oh, hey, can we get a consumer marketer? Because that's who we sort of are selling to when we want to get in their mind and we want to understand, okay, what do they want? What do they not want? And there's always that huge disconnect there. So I love that.
Yes, same to both what Jen and Sam said. You need to find someone who can compliment you. Product marketing is also a really important one, I think, to nail early. The one that I'm really hot to trot on, though, is customer marketing. So if you can't find someone who has the lived-in experience, then you need to find a customer marketer who can go immerse themselves in that experience. Again, this isn't for every business model, but a lot of folks this year were challenged with thinking through customer retention. And they were like, I wish I'd invested in customer marketing a lot earlier to help me with retaining my customers and or expanding my customers. Customer marketing is starting to look more and more like the original demand generation world. They're looking more like post-sale account-based program managers. And I think that that's a really important investment to make. Again, assuming your business model can support this. And you don't have a high transactional, high velocity sales motion, that customer retention really does matter a lot to you. So that's another one that I'm encouraging folks. And I'll say it here. I think the new CMO needs to do a stint in the customer marketing world, because our lives are stretched across the entire customer journey, not just in the pre-sale process.
Okay. And what are you defining as customer marketing? Is it essentially how you speak to someone who's already a current customer and how you retain them, or how are you sort of defining that?
Yeah. So customer marketing is like this all encompassing job right now. So you have to work on the voice of your customer and work on that word of mouth referral that's happening in ecosystems that you're not involved with. Some of that's organic, like in G2 Crowd or Trust Radius. Other of that is just like in this, all the 7,000 Slack groups that exist with people in their subsets of expertise, are they like shouting your name and saying like, yeah, you got to check out this company. They're my go-to for X. They're my go-to for this. Just that organic word of mouth. But I think what that ends up doing, though, is you have to also have someone in the customer marketing world to help with the economics of customer retention and think about your customers as another funnel for your business, and use that as an exponential growth lever for your business to retain those customers and be thinking about expansion within that install base of customers. It's the same motion for demand gen marketers or account-based marketers. It's just you should actually be more familiar with your customers because they're your customers. They've been with you, they've invested in you. So your job should be just that much more fun because you get to work with people who actually want to work with you instead of prospects who are ignoring your CTA at the email and say, like, got 15 minutes, got 20 minutes, right? They actually want to work with you on this stuff.
Yeah. And they're probably really amazing with feedback, right? And telling you what you could be doing better on a regular basis. When I was still wearing my growth hat and going into different companies, even consumer companies where, you know, like, you know, obviously B2B companies, each individual customer you have has a pretty high price point and pretty high kind of like customer net value to your bottom line. But it, where in consumer, you know, you might have customers who spend maybe $50 to $100, $150 with you in a year, which is a lot less than B2B. But even when I go into a lot of those consulting gigs, the first thing I would ask is, what are your customers saying about you? And the founders would very frequently be like, I don't know. I mean, our customer service team handles that. I was like, no. Okay, pick up the phone and just call 100 people. And it's surprising how many learnings come from that. And I think B2B companies do an amazing job of that, of consistently, you know, keeping in contact because you have account managers, you have people whose job it is to do that. But B2C companies almost never pick up the phone and just ask their customer, like, oh, did you like our product? How was the price point? How'd you find us? And the answers I've gotten when I've pushed teams to do that have been pretty illuminating. Like, for example, one company, every one of their customers just knew the founder. The founder was kind of famous in Boston. And it was like, that's not a viable model. That's not going to scale. You being a minor celebrity isn't a business model. So we need to build something out that's a little bit more viable here. So yeah, that's awesome.
To MK's point on that, I was talking to the I don't know if he's still there or not, the chief revenue officer at 15.5, which is an HR software. And he blew my mind when he said, like, we could 30X our revenue without adding another logo. I think and Slack's done an amazing job of this, where you no longer just have to sell to the C-suite or the VP or the, you know, purchasing office or whatever. You can, you know, expand inside of a business and organization. It makes your math weird because your customer lifetime value is infinity if you have net dollar retention over 100%. So that's a fun equation to try and solve. But it's a really good problem to have. You know, if you can just focus on expanding adoption inside of an organization or getting people to use more features, et cetera, it's an easier battle to win. And it's one that not enough people invest in, which, like, retention, upsell, and then using the customers to acquire more customers.
Okay. And I love that you named a couple companies that you think have done really well at focusing on kind of like bottoms up growth instead of just completely net new logos. Yeah, that's really great. What is the optimal marketing team structure for a small to mid-sized B2B organization? And digging into that one layer deeper, some organizations we work with have sort of made, let's say, one VP or CMO atop and a ton of, you know, ICs reporting into that CMO or VP. And then others we've seen are very kind of structured where there's multiple tiers, VP, director, another, you know, maybe marketing manager below and a lot more functional in that mindset. I'd love to hear your thoughts on having, let's say you were building up, like, you know, a 6 to 9 person team, you know, is it necessary to have those tiers in there for management structure, or let's just hire good ICs who are specialists and let them run wild and they can all report into one person? I've seen it built out both ways. So I'm curious your thoughts.
At least from my perspective, it depends on the specialization that you have in the team and how you've actually structured your team. So Jen, Sam, and I each gave our own 2 cents on, like, the 3 folks you need to have to start off. But beyond those 3 folks, your business may look and feel very different. At least at Alice, our marketing team, I own the BDR function. And so for me, that means that I do need to hire a manager in this function to manage the efficacy of the BDRs. That's more of a repeatable process. It's not going to have the nuance and subtlety that, like, maybe a marketing specialist might need to have. So that person has hierarchy baked into that. But the rest of the folks on the team, their specialties are just so niche right now that they have to report to me directly. That doesn't make sense for the hierarchy to exist if you have a product marketer, demand generation, account-based marketer, and a growth specialist. Like, that each one of those are just such neat, and don't forget brand too. It's like each one of these are so niche that you couldn't really nestle one under the other and allow the full maximal potential under of each of the separate roles.
It's a really good point.
And I will say, I do think it's optimal for BDRs to live under marketing. That's it.
You got career path versus, like, what they do. And that's where I always say that I don't have a territorial bone in my body. And right now I own sales and marketing. So someday when we do hire BDRs, obviously, hi. But it just depends. Like I've also been, I've had empire builders who are my sales peers. And for me, my relationship with sales is so important that I'm not gonna, you know, like die on that hill.
Interesting. Okay. I'm trying to figure out your answer there.
Oh, as to whether, I didn't actually answer the question, if that's what you're asking. My answer to every single question is, it depends. What are you trying to do? I'm kind of known for that.
Okay.
And the answer is, who can you find and what can they cover? Because one thing that so I actually changed careers into marketing with starting at HubSpot. And one thing that I learned coming from IT into marketing is that every human being has a different set of skills, right? So I came into the consulting team, and who could manage small businesses was different than the people who could manage large companies, was different than the people who could manage e-commerce, and e-commerce on the HubSpot platform was super fun and you guys are amazing. But it really comes down to who was that first hire and then what can they do? Like maybe they are, you know, managers born, or maybe they're strategically minded. Well, then great. I'm not going to prohibit them from getting a director title and having people under them. Or maybe they're super happy as an IC, and then I should hire alongside them instead of under them. Because my job as a marketing leader is not just to build marketing and not just to build revenue, but also to build people.
After that.
Yeah. Love that.
Love that. I like that. You're so much cooler than I am. Dispelling any notion that I'm cool, by the way, I think of management layers the same way that they think about Horcruxes in the Harry Potter series. You can't tear your soul into more than seven people or seven pieces. So if you have like a 6 or 7 person organization, you don't really need management layers. Once you get beyond that though, you end up, you know, like let's say you have like 11 people. That's kind of too much for one person to manage directly. And so you either have to have a couple of managers who have just like not that many people reporting to them, or you start to split off the team depending on what you need, like Jen said. I mean, less than sort of 7 or 10 people, you kind of have one person for each part of the funnel that you're optimizing for. Once you start growing beyond that is also when it gets weird. So what are the growth goals? I think y'all use it in the description, the skate to the puck thing with marketing organizational design, where your marketing team is always going to be either too big or too small and structured in the wrong way for where you are right now. Because you can't just like add on more sales reps, you know, what you can do with sales. You can just add on more sales reps. They have a payback period, et cetera. But in marketing, if you want to shift to being a globally oriented team, or if you want to shift to, you know, being a brand focused team, or if you're just trying to build for the next phase of growth, that's going to require a different structure. I mean, how often did we reorg, Jen, back in the day? Like
always.
Yeah. Maybe. But that's because like what you need today is not necessarily what you're going to need 6 months from now. And then you have to make the decision, do I like burn the cost and the change management of changing the organization to be what it needs to be? Or do I just like let the organization be a little overstressed, you know, for a while because they're being asked to do more than they're designed or resourced to do? So the smaller teams are actually easier. And this is a big mistake that people make, is they hire too many people too fast, not realizing that going from a team to an organization is a big change. And also, like, again, factoring in your company's growth goals, the cash on hand, all the rest of that. You have to, you know, people aren't volunteers. They factor into the CAC model.
Well, I'm sorry, you're paying your employees? Hold on, I got to talk to Aether real fast.
I'm actually not yet, but that's because all of ours are early stage HubSpotters. So we're going to take salaries in January.
I was going to say we're in that stage as well.
Yeah. I have to figure out, I'm trying to choose between paychecks and TriNet right now, which is not a question I've ever had to answer before. So
we use TriNet a little. Have you used the trick to get a discount from TriNet?
No, pray tell. This is a great one.
Oh yeah. Yeah. It's great. You basically just say you work at a WeWork and then you get their like lowest tier of pricing. You know, I don't actually work in a WeWork. So
not that we're advocating for unethical behavior here, but right now you can't work at a WeWork, right?
No, you can. WeWork actually is one of those companies that did not close during the pandemic for a lot of their locations.
I think ours is closed here.
Yeah. It's closed there? Oh. Huh.
Seattle is really shut down at the moment.
Ah, okay. We'll go on to the next question. When do you scale into, you know, building out a full sales team? I'm thinking this has some layers backing into product market fit. Where is that line? How do you know you have it? And so forth.
I'm dying to know what Sam has to say, because he and I are thinking we're seven people at Orsted right now. So I'm like, so Sam?
I mean, I would reverse that question, which is I build marketing and product organizations after I do the sales thing. I mean, we don't know what to build until we've started selling. So my co-founder, Greg, and I were talking to customers and seeing what people would actually pay an invoice for, setting expectations that like it's not going to exist yet, you know, before we actually built a marketing team. You know, we had more salespeople than marketers. I mean, salespeople are, I mean, really good at, it's the one-on-one interaction, right? So like whatever sales does is something that you can scale. What phrases are they using? What value propositions, positioning statements are they using? What sequences are they using? What channels, who are the best and worst customers? You know, all of those things are questions that the marketing organization is great at scaling the answers to, but no AI or automation yet created is better than an actual, even junior, inexperienced human being in terms of figuring out the answers to those questions. So I build up the sales team or the sales like people generally almost first, if not at least very, very early. And then the sales organization, I mean, if it fits into the CAC model. David Skok at the Four Entrepreneurs blog has a great article, or maybe it's, I might be thinking of the wrong blog, but the payback period on hiring sales reps, you know, you break even after a certain point, just like you would with a customer. And then you balance your growth goals with the marketing team's pipeline. So the marketing team, don't overhire your sales team and then complain that your marketing team can't keep up. So at scaling the organization is a math problem. Building the organization to begin with is an empathy problem. It's a people problem. Can you understand your customers really, really well and then scale that up? Is that the answer you thought I was going to give, Jen? I don't.
Yes. And the reason I say yes is because it's interesting, because to me, I've never been the CEO. I tend to be the second in command or part of the executive team. And in founding this company and trying to grow it up, it becomes, how salesy is the CEO? If there's a product-driven CEO, then you're probably going to hire somebody who can do all the sales things. And that means, you know, the jack of all trades, somebody who's not been a superstar enterprise sales rep, but who also knows how to use Salesforce or HubSpot CRM or how an Excel spreadsheet or however you're tracking your sales motion. Right now, my company has a salesy CEO. So I'm spending a lot of time putting in sales process around somebody who's never had to deal with a sales process and doing some marketing on the side. But, you know, we're still figuring out what we're selling and to whom. And that's where we are too.
And I would say, like, what does full-fledged sales team even mean right now, right? Because you're still, even Alice, who I think is a little further along in their maturation than Jen and Sam's company, we're still trying to define where our product market fit is for this product. That's like shiny object. Everybody really likes it, but we really need to be more refined with that. And we're also means we're going to need to change our selling motion or just graduate out of the next phase of us being like, just put bodies, butts in seats so you can just start selling and get a proof of concept out here. So now, like, we look at our team, we need to mature, we need to scale our organization and look at folks that do really understand the sales process in the enterprise space. So full-fledged, like, yeah, we'll flip that back. Like, what does that actually mean to businesses? It'll all be different depending on the size and phase of your growth.
I suppose that means once you have salespeople who aren't willing to pound the phones all day. In a startup, you can't just hire a seasoned like sales leader if they're not going to actually like pick up the phone and call.
Yes.
So I don't know.
And there's also a scale point. So at Bizible, we had 8 BDRs who had kind of figured it out. And then right before I started, it scaled to 40 BDRs with no leadership, no training, and no product marketing, because I actually came in to be the executive in charge of that function. And I remember I started and I always meet with my peers and I'm like, what do you need? What do you need? And the VP of sales is like, help me with the BDRs, because there's a big difference between the kind of slightly funky startup-y BDRs we had that learned how to do the function and then taking that and then suddenly blowing it up to a lot of, honestly, people who had come from not startup world and not sales, right? We found them in retail. We found them at car dealerships. We found them at all the places that you'll find a BDR. And so you have to consider leadership as well as the butts in the seats really carefully, because honestly, we struggled to meet for the BDR? Is there opportunity goals and for us to meet our revenue goals because we just suddenly went boom without any thought of like, oh, well, the first 8 figured it out. What about the next, 32? Well, it didn't quite work that way.
Made too many Horcruxes. I'm telling you, 7. Can't do more of that. I have an issue to think, probably controversial topic, the chief revenue officer of the unified GTM team role. Like at Flock, I had sales, I had marketing, I had success. And then for some reason, I also had VI ops. It felt like it was way too much. But at the same time, it did help driving like alignment. I don't know if while we're going off script and just writing our own controversial questions, how do you think about like the relationship between, because MK brought it up, like with the BDRs, the relationship between the sales and account management team and the marketing org?
I mean, I'll do whatever it takes to build a relationship. And I have stories about, double bourbons with a BDR manager at 11 a.m. because that was the only way I could get him to talk to me. I sat on a couch and wrote for the rest of that day and then heavily edited in case anybody was wondering. So, but I have the CRO role right now. And the only reason I can really do it is, well, first of all, I've done it before. I did it at Recruit Loop. But the other thing is that being heavily into product marketing and the jack of all trades that requires, I've actually already designed a sales process. I've already designed a comp plan. I've already put together all the workflows in Salesforce. And so it just makes sense right now for that all to center on me. But I also feel like, our biggest call to action at Bizible was, hey, CMOs don't want to answer to a CRO. There's an assumption that chief revenue officer is a salesperson. And as a marketing person in that role, I've got tons of marketers asking me to mentor them. And I'm like, I don't know what I'm doing yet. But I think my basic answer here, Sam, is I don't know. It depends. And I'll find out.
Fair enough.
What needs to be addressed?
I don't know. I like the I don't know and I depend combo now that progressed in the it depends.
Yes.
That's awesome. What do you need to have in place before you hire your first salesperson? And it's interesting the point that Jen brought up. If you have a product-driven CEO, you might need to have another salesperson earlier because I was always under the mindset if you are selling something that needs a sales process and a B2B process, if you're selling a B2B product or a service-oriented organization, you need to have sold some of it before even bringing in a salesperson. Even if sales isn't your forte, you should have tried selling and you should have had some success with selling. Otherwise, you're bringing someone else in to sell something that you couldn't sell yourself. Almost seems like a little bit of a bad recipe because you may be selling something that shouldn't be sold and isn't easily sellable. But I'd love to hear more thoughts on like, what should be in place before you even hire your first salesperson? Should a CEO have already had to have sold X amount of the product or gotten, some promises that someone will buy X amount of product?
And didn't you literally just go through this?
Yeah. I mean, I would probably fundamentally disagree, which is that interpersonal interaction in the sales and the sales motion, the sales discipline at that stage of a company is, I don't know if I want to say rarer skill, but it's more impactful. Like engineering, you can figure it out. If you figure out what people want, you can find somebody to build it. You can get the investment to build it. Same thing with marketing, et cetera. That beginning stage where you're just going out there and talking to people, you're finding out what they like, what they don't like about the current solutions. You're trying to get them to actually pay and commit. I mean, Andre, my CTO, is easily one of the most talented and brilliant technology people I've ever met. I'm like moderately good at my job too, but we wouldn't be here if it wasn't for Greg, our third co-founder, who just like, he's like, what is it we're selling? He's like, cool. He's like, I got the CMO from CVS on the line. He's like, what are we selling them? Andre and I can come up with smart ideas, but without somebody who's actually going to like throw themselves against the market and find out how the market is going to let them move forward or push back, then the smartest ideas don't matter. So
I love that.
That's true. Yeah. But when I've worked for CEOs who haven't sold the product, then they don't understand why sales ever misses. They're like, what do you mean? It's a numbers game. This should be easy. And it's like, well, actually, that's a skill. Like, hold on a second. So that's why I actually like it when the CEO has at least tried to sell. And it's just empathy. You need empathy for everyone under you. It doesn't mean you should be easy on them, but you need to at least try to understand so that you know, okay, I can push here versus I can't.
So the dual co-founder thing is always a good thing, right? Like you had a person with a sales background at HubSpot and a person with an engineering background. And like having worked on projects with both of them individually, I'm confident there'd be no HubSpot without both of them because it's just hard to be good in all of those ways. I had that happen to me. One of my engineering leads in India came up to me at Flock, and they're like, I guess I just never thought sales and marketing was hard. Like, we build it, you just have to sell it. Because I gave a little like crash course on how go-to-market works. And yeah, that's true. If you don't have a leader that has empathy for what it's like to actually have to pick up the phone and sell and then have the thing break when you're on a demo, et cetera, like, then that person's not going to make as good decisions. That's true.
Yeah. Or had to kind of rebut when someone is not interested in their product or doesn't understand it or doesn't get it. We definitely work with founders where they flat out don't understand why everybody in the world isn't like jumping up and down to give money for their product and have never been on a call with trying to get someone to jump up and down to get money. So I think it was just maybe some poor experiences where I've dealt with that in the past where my opinion comes from. But I love the idea of having that great three-person co-founding team, because that person can start conversations while you're still building the product and gauge whether someone, once you have the product actually built, will want to give you money for it. Maybe a little bit. And so right when it's ready for prime time, you know, you'll have some of those customers right there. So that's a really great point. I'd love to hear all of your mistakes, every single one of them, in building a B2B marketing org. Ideally, your most obvious mistake, which you've taken with you into your future roles to hopefully course correct on.
We're all like, not it.
I'm like, we can only just pick one.
Oh, okay. Multiple of wonderful as well.
I mean, for me, it's been hiring too fast, right? Like, even if sometimes it's better to let things go unhandled, unaddressed, unmanaged, than it is to you know, hire a team so fast that you can't get the organization working together. There's no alignment. Like, you can't execute. You end up with culture issues, and you're not aligned with sort of the economics of the business. If you're going to a startup, by the way, and they can't tell you how the marketing organization is supposed to fit into the CAC model or give you some sort of objective benchmark, you should push back hard on that, because you want to build the organization as complex and as fast as makes sense for the business. And usually that answer is more slowly than you think. I've rarely seen organizations that are like, oh, we need to grow the marketing team faster than we actually have. You know, it's usually like you're adding people at an appropriate pace, or, you know, you're calculating like the LTV to CAC, right? Like, that's something that the CMO, one of the things I really took away from working with Jen and y'all back in the day was like, the math and the economics of it matters to marketers. We're not just sitting in the corner playing with crayons, right? Like, we need to have some sort of like justification for the business value that we're creating. And I think if you don't go into it with that mindset, then yeah, you're gonna make a lot of mistakes. Been there.
That's fascinating. What do you think leads to a marketing organization growing faster than it really should and hiring faster? Is it because there's someone in another function who sort of just like built out random forecasts and just told you this marketing team should be 52 people, go? Is it part of that, or is there something else?
Lack of discipline. I mean, excitement is good, but if you don't have that discipline, you're not tracking like, where is the funnel broken? Where do I need to optimize? How is the marketing team contributing to the, you know, the unit economics of the business? If you're not approaching it from that perspective, which lots of people don't, then you're gonna make mistakes. Or especially if you're really heavily funded, right? Like, you've just got the money. It's hard to say like, I'm not gonna hire people even though I have the budget, knowing that there's a lot of pain and confusion and misalignment that happens when you know, I took over Flock, and in 6 months we went from like a 7-person marketing team to like a 35-person marketing team or something like that. And that was not a good idea.
Mm. I've never had budget to do that. I'm sitting here going like, oh, that would be amazing.
Find a billionaire co-founder.
Noted.
Jen or MK, any other hard lessons you've learned from making mistakes?
For me, it goes back to the Harry Potter reference of the Horcruxes. And when you have too many direct reports, sometimes the direct report that is the loudest is where you're going to end up spending most of your time. But that doesn't always mean that that's the right person to be spending your time and energy on. If you are spread thin, you have a more horizontal organization, and you are very well aware of the leaky funnel that you might have or the inefficiencies in your funnel, you're going to have to tell that person that they need to figure it out or make the decision, like, can you not figure it out? And that's a different conversation. But you need to be investing time and energy with the folks on your team that are actually going to drive the impact that your organization needs to make. And that's tough, especially when someone is saying in a startup mode, like, freaking out, man. It's way too hard, way too much for me to do all at once. And so you can have empathy for that person going through that experience at the time, but also know full well that you need to empower and enable them to either shape up or shape out, and then invest your time and energy working on those problems, like your product marketing, your positioning, your competitive differentiators, that kind of stuff. And that's tough to do when you do care about the people that you are working with and working towards a really common, really excellent goal toward together.
And my biggest mistake has been assuming just because my peers or on the executive team and my boss say, yes, I understand this, means that they actually understand how to do marketing. And this has been a real shock in MarTech companies, because you kind of assume that people who are selling marketing products to marketers actually have some clue what marketing needs. And the answer is actually no. And so for me, it's clarifying assumptions more than once, because just because somebody's like, yes, absolutely, no problem, this is exactly what we should do, doesn't mean they're not going to turn around in the next month once the sales team has missed and said, why did we do that? It's like, but you under what? And so for me, I'm an over communicator by nature, but I don't necessarily repeat myself. And so it's really making sure that not only have I said the right words and they've said the right words back, but they truly understand why we're scaling, what direction we're scaling, what the impact of the scale actually means. And this is why we have this role that I fought for, as an example.
That's really great. Thank you to everyone for coming here and teaching us so much about how to scale B2B marketing organizations and giving all of your personal trials and tribulations of getting there.
Thanks for tuning in to Culture, Talent, and Growth. If you found value in this conversation, please leave a review, subscribe, and share this episode with a friend. You can visit bringruckus.com for more ways to connect. And remember, new episodes come out on Tuesday.